Cyberspace has become an arena for countries to compete with each other and to make investments with material benefits and income for countries' budgets. But it has also turned into an effective weapon, like military weapons, and has become a threat to the security of national states. This is why countries have begun to invest heavily in this field. According to a study prepared by the Ventrun Cybersecurity magazine, in which the first 500 companies working in the cyber field were counted, America ranks first with 354 companies, followed by 42 Israeli companies, then 21 British companies. The study shows that another 40 Israeli companies are registered in the United States of America for tax reasons, thus bringing the actual number of Israeli cyber companies to 82 out of 500, or 16.4%. This makes Israel genuinely afraid of the emergence of new players in this field, most notably Iran, China, and Russia. Despite Israel's pursuit of excellence in this field by increasing its cyber power, this did not stop it from being exposed to Iranian cyber attacks. Israel accuses Iran of the attack that targeted Aramco in 2012. Again, in 2012, Israel accused Iran of being responsible for the attack that targeted the water stations. Israel then, in alleged retaliation, cyber attacked the strategic port of Bandar Abbas. Most recently, in an ongoing series of cyber attacks, Israel claims that Iran-based groups successfully obtained credit card details from hundreds of Israelis and proceeded to leak them online. Hackers targeted several tourism agencies in Israel, obtaining the financial information of thousands of customers and sending hundreds of threatening SMS messages to hacked tourist customers. Iran and Israel are testing each other, though, with great caution, as the recent targets indicated Iran's ability to penetrate Israeli cyberspace and that the latter is not well protected. There is consequently real fear in Israel for any war or cyber attack, and this is what preoccupies analysts, political commentators, and military leaders in the occupation entity. It is true that no human life has been lost in these wars so far, because the protective belts used by Israel wants to be very effective. But over time, Iranian attacks may become more complex. For example, if an attack targets the electricity network or internet services in Israel or the banking system, this reflects negatively on the lives of the Israelis, which may cause the collapse of the system in Tel Aviv. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In spite of Israel's pursuit of superiority in the field of cyber power, its most secure firewalls were not enough to not stop it from being exposed to Iranian cyber attacks. Despite the fact that Israeli companies occupy advanced ranks in the field of cyber technology, they still fear Iranian capabilities. And this fear is due to the recent cyber attacks allegedly attributed to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, there is consequently real fear inside of the Israeli entity of any cyber attack, preoccupying its analysts and especially its military leaders, especially amid the escalation of the Israeli and Iranian mutual threats in light of Israel's cyber attacks that aim to disrupt Iran's nuclear facilities. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hadi Shatila, founder of iBreathe Media. Thank you very much for being with us, Hadi.
Thank you for having
now,
me.
Cyber has increasingly become a space for strategic confrontation between Israel and Iran, two rather advanced states in cyber capabilities over the past decade. In fact, Iran and Israel have engaged in a long-running cyber warfare conflict throughout the very past decade that we have witnessed. What do you think is the real impact of this non-noisy warfare?
Well, first of all, we have to get things clear that it's not noisy, but it does have its repercussions. And it usually comes in tandem with other types of aggressions, at least from the Israeli side. Like, for example, it comes the Stuxnet worm, which targeted the nuclear facilities. It started in 2005 during the Bush administration and continued till 2017. With Obama, it targeted many infrastructures for the nuclear program and came in tandem with assassinations for top nuclear scientists. So it's not very quiet as it may seem. It usually has bigger strategical implications and comes as a big package with other things, as I said, like, for example, assassinations. So that's one part. You can see that, for example, it may come for exposure of private information for some entities. It might come as something to destroy the work of the actual machines that that make the program, for example, the Iranian program, that the worm used to target the actual machinery and systems as a base technical level. Whereas this worm itself spread outside of the nuclear program and made a mess to many companies and many individuals around the world, as it was a vulnerability inside most of the systems. Mm-hmm. So it was targeted for Iran, but it made a lot of fuss outside. It made a problem on a nuclear program level and on an individual level, as well as how Iran used to retaliate. They used to target websites relating to the government, to private institutions. They used to target the phones of generals or top leaders in the Israeli army or the intelligence system. So that's how it goes. It goes back and forth, both systems attacking each other, and sometimes you have collateral damage.
But Hadi, from the Israeli side, cyber attacks combined with the cognitive warfare of civilian organizations in Iran aims to create public opinion pressure against the government inside of the Islamic Republic. However, we have seen it before initiated against the Natanz nuclear site in Iran and against the Iranian steel industry just last week. One question everyone wants answered is, how can Iran possibly stop such attacks from becoming a direct risk of human life?
Okay, to stop it directly, stop the actual attack, it's quite not impossible, improbable. It can reduce the risk of the attack by employing awareness campaigns for the actual people who work on these systems to limit private use of their internet, to limit. They should put ground rules of how the users or the people working in possible institutions that might be targeted to have a more secure interfacing with their systems, with their laptops, with their phones, even their private ones. They might put systems to do that, to limit the breach, limit the effect of these worms, these viruses, the malware, the ransomware, whatever type of attack they might be doing, on the location or local scale of the attack. And to limit the hurt or the effects on their lives, it's a different thing all in all. This should be something followed up by actual intelligence systems to provide the needed protection. For example, if let's say, God forbid, something happens at the nuclear facility and it blows up, this error should be faced before the attack, like evacuation or control policies, etc. So there should be security policies on the internet use, security policies on the systems, mm-hmm. security policies on the actual people who work there, their families, so that they don't get breached through maybe a child playing a game on his gaming system, downloads something which gets attacks his local network, which transfers to his parents' items like mobile phones or laptops, who then themselves take it to their location of work. There are many ways where infiltrations can happen. Mm-hmm. These should be sourced out, they should be noticed, and they should have contingency plans.
Mm-hmm. Well, Hadi, this mutual warfare allows both sides to convey whatever strategic messages that they want, but it also has a price for Israel. A demonstration of cyber attacks capabilities leads to the other side being some sort of vaccinated against such cyber attacks, against those cyber weapons, and generally improving Iran's cyber defenses because they are learning from what's going on. How do you think these attacks and counterattacks will shape the role of cyber warfare in the next decade, because it seems to be intensifying?
Okay, one thing you can notice is, if you step back a little bit, if you can notice that even in media, there are sometimes these call outs onto these cyber attacks, etc. Like, for example, the Iranian series called Gandu, they had this security attacks, etc. Also on cyber attacks were covered inside this series, which is a fictional series based on true events. Then Israel came, they replied with another TV series called Tehran, which calls out for Israeli spy who infiltrates Iran, and she is a hacker. So they are employing this in their fiction as well as in their facts. And also you can see that with each attack, the attack level is higher. That's why, because with practice, people become better or perfect. This recurring attacks from and to will make both sides more powerful, make them even more creative in how they tackle these things. But this usually involves adding a human element. For example, in the series, they sent the agent to Tehran to be able to infiltrate the firewalls, the mm-hmm. protective systems, so that she interfaces with the actual systems that are linked to the nuclear program, the missile protection or anti-missile systems that protect
the ones which are usually hard to affect online.
Exactly. They have to be accessed directly, like through hardware.
On location.
Yeah, and this effect. So they're always adding these ideas that you need this human element, which is used not by actual cyber warfare, but by the intelligence system, which implores the cyber warfare. Mm-hmm. So they will be adding people in tandem to this system, not actual online attacks. Or like through proxies, for example, they would target a family. Then the people should be careful who their family interacts with, etc. So it's a very mishmashed thing.
Especially in a world where devices now rule our entire existence. Definitely proves that the upcoming years will be highlighted with maybe more creative
more events, exactly.
Cyber warfare. So I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hadi Shatila, founder of iBreathe Media, for this compact and inclusive answers that you gave us, which we definitely need in such a new topic. Please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the advances and the capabilities of Ansarullah in Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the leader of the Ansarullah Yemeni resistance, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, announced that as his country enters its eighth year of confronting the U.S.-Saudi aggression, the production of various missiles is continuous and advanced, and it is day after day more accurate and more destructive. Al-Houthi declared that Yemen manufactures long-range ballistic missiles that reach any point in the countries taking part in the coalition of aggression. Yemen enhances its military arsenal in this following report.
The missile force and the unmanned air force have proven to be the absolute force that distinguishes it from the heavy use of ballistic missile defenses more than any conflict in the modern history of wars. Yemen's missiles have so far targeted sensitive sites that have confused the countries of the coalition of aggression and created a scene of panic and anxiety among their military ranks, namely those who possess an integrated military arsenal, especially Patriot missiles, to deter and shoot down ballistic missiles, but are unable so far to stop the attack or change the course of the conflict despite all the technology they possess. Local cadres of Yemen's Ansarullah continue to develop missile capabilities and an air force capable of striking any target in the depth of the countries of the coalition of aggression. Last week, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of the Yemeni revolution, revealed the continued development of Yemen's military capabilities, stressing the failure of American defense systems to confront Yemeni missiles. He said in a televised speech during his meeting with the sheikhs and dignitaries of Hajjah Governorate that Ansarullah are making long-range ballistic missiles gas that can reach any point in the countries of the aggression coalition at the level of neighboring countries. He stressed that the production of various missiles is continuing and developing, and it is becoming more accurate and more destructive day by day. Al-Houthi pointed out that various weapons, from pistols to Kalashnikovs to cannons to missiles, are now manufactured locally, and this is a great achievement that gives hope in various fields. Observers and political analysts said that there is no longer a safe place throughout Saudi geography, as Yemen has the ability to strike the most fortified targets, and that the Saudi regime has no choice but to submit to peace and a comprehensive and just political settlement. The 8-year war on Yemen has proven that the Saudi regime has a poor understanding of Yemen's repeated calls and initiatives for peace, which is what makes it persist in committing crimes against the Yemeni people. However, when the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia receives painful blows at the hands of the valiant Yemeni armed forces in a series of successive deterrence operations, it turns into a complainant to the international community and its masters in Washington, begging for protection. Military experts consider that the Yemenis succeeded in the use of missile power and air force to target their aggressors, and as part of an integrated strategy to increase costs and exhaust the military, economic, and political capabilities of the aggressors, significantly disrupting the economies of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Sydney is Jay Therapil, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Jay. Now, air and missile defense mechanisms in the possession of the forces of aggression did not succeed in eliminating the effectiveness of the Yemeni missiles and the Yemeni military capabilities. However, some Western experts considered Yemen's capabilities only a psychological deterrent to the targeted forces of aggression rather than an actual military deterrent capable of changing the balance of power on the ground. What's your take on this kind of analysis?
The reason why the Yemeni national resistance engages in a combination of drone and missile warfare is to force the Saudis and the Emiratis to pay a price for their genocidal war against Yemen. Therefore, it's not just psychological damage, it's the economic cost that this war is inflicting on the Saudi economy. The Saudis are using interceptor missiles that cost $4.3 million each to shoot down Yemeni drones that cost $1,000 each. As a result, the Saudis have spent over $400 billion on this war, and this is largely by breaking world records in the use of ballistic missile defenses, which is why the Brookings Institute calls it the greatest use of ballistic missile defenses of any conflict in history. Now, the problem for Saudi Arabia is that ever since the U.S. withdrew their eight Patriot missile defense systems from Saudi Arabia in June last year, the Saudis have been running low on interceptor missiles. And the U.S. and Britain are not interested in giving them missiles because they care, or the only thing they care about right now is getting Saudi Arabia to pump out more oil. So while the Saudis are running out of interceptor missiles, Yemen is manufacturing its own missiles. According to Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi from a week ago, Yemen today manufactures long-range ballistic missiles that can reach any point in the neighboring aggression countries. Or the neighboring aggressive countries, it should say. So Saudi Arabia, despite not being under siege and despite receiving hundreds of billions of dollars in loans and military aid, they are running out of missiles, whereas Yemen, which is under a genocidal siege, which is intended to prevent the resistance from even acquiring weapons, is now pounding Saudi oil installations using its own arsenal of reverse-engineered missiles.
Well, Jay, Yemen has become a force to be reckoned with today in the region, and the entire international community, despite American perseverance, has become certain of the impossibility of the U.S.'s victory or its own puppet's victory inside of Yemen. Given now this fact and with the start of the countdown to the end of the ongoing current truce in Yemen, might extending the truce be in favor of the aggressors than it is in favor of Yemen at the moment?
You can certainly make the argument that this UN brokered truce, which supposedly began in April, favors the Saudi-led aggressors for the simple reason that only the Yemeni national resistance is ever expected to adhere to the terms of the truce, whereas the Saudis violate the truce all the time. Mm-hmm. Up until now, the Yemen Press Agency, which is based in the capital Sana'a, has recorded 169 violations of that truce, which means that the front lines are still very much active and the people of Yemen are still being starved by the blockade. However, ever since the truce was announced in April, the Saudis have refrained from the more brazen acts of aggression, like, you know, wantonly bombing civilian areas using their air force. And there are two reasons, I think, why Saudi Arabia agreed to the truce. And the first reason is because the Yemeni drone and missile attack on Aramco facilities on the 25th of March, which caused an explosion very close to the Formula One Grand Prix. Mm-hmm. After the operation, Ansarullah, through its spokesman Mohammed al-Bukhaiti, indicated that Yemen was sending the message that it had the capability to disrupt the flow of oil. The CEO of Aramco then told the New York Times that the ability of Yemen to hit Saudi oil infrastructure was a real concern for the world. So the Saudis have been openly admitting that they are vulnerable. The second reason is because the major concern for the West right now is oil prices, which I mentioned before, and oil prices peaked at $120 per barrel in June, and It now sits at $100 per barrel, although this price reduction has mostly been achieved in the West, at least, by reducing consumption through raising interest rates rather than increasing production. Mm-hmm. So the Yemeni resistance has exposed the embarrassing fact that Saudi Arabia does not have any spare capacity when it comes to oil production. 2 days ago, oilprice.com put out a damning report by Simon Watkins that accused Saudi Arabia of grossly exaggerating its capacity for producing crude oil. To give you the big picture, Saudi Arabia has been claiming for the past 30 years that they have about 260 billion barrels of crude oil, and yet they've exported 95 billion barrels since 1973, but they still claim that they have around 260 billion barrels, which is mathematically impossible.
Definitely. But we have another aggressor here in the region that is somehow fearful of Yemen, talking about none other than Israel. It's kind of on its toes analyzing the Yemeni arsenal and the ballistic missiles and the armed drones capabilities. Now, we have the Israeli Institute for National Security Studies claiming that Ansarullah's constant rhetoric against Israel and their accumulation of a large stock of weapons, they put the Israeli leaders in front of the dilemma of being dragged into the Yemeni quagmire as if they haven't yet been involved there. But how do you perceive Yemen's role in the event of a regional war between pro-Israeli camp and the axis of resistance?
Well, from the Yemeni perspective, they really only have one mission, which is to compel the aggressors to stop waging war on Yemen, to get them to lift the siege on Yemen, and finally to recognize the revolutionary government in the capital, Sana'a, as the legitimate and official government of Yemen. So in this context, I think Israel will end up providing direct assistance to Saudi Arabia. I say this because we learned just over a week ago that the U.S. was brokering these secret talks between the Saudis and Israel to discuss joint cooperation against Iran, which will probably mean Israeli troops being deployed to Saudi Arabia to intercept Yemeni drones and missiles. Saudi Arabia agreed to the truce 3 months ago, I believe, for two reasons. One, because Yemeni drones and missiles threatened to raise oil prices at a time when the West wants to drive down oil prices, both for its own consumption and to hurt Russia. And two, because the Saudis are running out of interceptor missiles. And so the U.S. doesn't really want to help them anymore, which is why the Saudis are trying to use this period, which they call the truce, to secure direct Israeli military assistance. And in return, Israel is trying to get more recognition from the Gulf monarchy so that it can improve its reputation in the Arab world and the Sunni Muslim world more broadly. So Israel is currently setting up military bases on Socotra Island. So they are involved with the UAE, with the Emiratis, in the illegal occupation of Yemeni territory. And that means that if the truce finally ends and the war intensifies, then the Yemeni national resistance could begin to attack the IDF on Socotra Island with their missiles, But beyond direct involvement by the IDF against Yemen, it's really hard to say what else could happen. Although I do know that there's also talk, like there's escalating rhetoric between the resistance in Lebanon and Israel because Israel is stealing Lebanese gas. So that might also enter into the equation as well.
Well, it seems that we're looking at a very hot summer here in the region. Jay, thank you for being with us from Sydney. Mr. Jay Therapel, political commentator, for explaining to us how this arsenal by the Yemeni resistance will actually benefit Yemen against the aggressors and the masters, basically, in Washington. Thank you very much for your contribution. And please stay tuned next week for more of very hot topics from the region of West Asia on the Mideast Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today we complete our explanation of Surah Waqi'ah, that is, the imminent hour or the inevitable event to occur at the end of time. As we have already explained to you, it refers to the day of resurrection, followed by the final judgment, which the disbelievers deny in fear of the sorting out of good and evil, since people on that day will be divided into three classes. Those brought near to the divine threshold for having reached the highest degree of faith, those on the right hand, or ordinary believers who made mistakes but turned in repentance to Allah and thereafter lived a pious life, and those on the left hand, that is, the disbelievers who denied God's message and the prophets, lived in sins, and died in the state of disbelief. Ample proof is given in this surah of the infinite power of the Almighty Creator and consequently His ability to bring about the resurrection. If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last week, we said the evolutionary process should make any rational person realize the power of God Almighty to raise the dead to life, especially in view of the fact that the Noble Quran presents the most logical arguments by arguing readers to reflect on the wonders of the world of creation, as well as upon their own selves to attain faith and eventually the bliss of paradise, instead of committing wrongs and plunging into the fires of hell. We also pointed out to the elixir of life, that is water, which pours down from the clouds to make rivers flow and vegetation to grow, saying that the very power that makes seeds in the soil sprout and become plants is able to raise to life the dead humans on the day of resurrection. In other words, whether it is the development of agriculture or the process of procreation, we human beings might be the instruments of action, but it is the will of God that provides us with a rich variety of crops and the birth of babies and their development into perfect persons blessed with manifold talents. All these ought to inspire us to celebrate the glory of the all-wise Creator and express gratitude to Him instead of being thankless and turning into disbelievers and sinners. Listen to ayahs 75, 76, 77, 78, 79, 80, 81, and 82 of Surah Waqia.
فلا أقسم بمواقع النجوم وإنه لقسم لو تعلمون عظيم إنه لقرآن كريم في كتاب مكنون لا يمسه إلا المطهرون تنزيل من رب العالمين أفبهذا الحديث أنتم مدهنون وتجعلون رزقكم أنكم تكذبون
ناي I swear by the orbit of the stars, and indeed it is a great oath, should you know. This is indeed a Qur'an, the most honorable. In a guarded book, the preserved tablet, no one touches it except the pure ones. A revelation gradually sent down from the Lord of all the worlds. What? Do you take lightly this discourse? And make your denial of it your vocation or livelihood? These ayahs ascertain the flawless veracity of the Noble Qur'an, which is indeed an eternal miracle for the guidance of all mankind, granted by the Almighty Creator to His last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Ayah 76 is thus a divine oath by emphasis on the places and orbits of the stars, which are billions or more in number, and follow their fixed courses with precision as per the law of gravity without any collision. This makes the oath on the honor the status of the Quran far more significant. A scientist and any rational person should affirm based on the discoveries of more and more galaxies that remarkably function in an orderly manner, as is evident by our own solar system and its planets, including our wonderful Earth. Without the least doubt, this is a great oath, making an extraordinary announcement that the Quran, to use the Arabic word in the ayah, Karim, O the most honorable, for the bounties it opens for the believers in various paths. Therefore, what has been revealed to the Prophet for the guidance of humanity is preserved in a well-guarded tablet, which means the Noble Quran ought to be touched in the state of cleanliness after due ablution. In order to properly understand its dynamic contents for leading a sound and healthy life away from sins and with enthusiasm for expanding the vistas of knowledge, while only the thoroughly purified ones know its esoteric meanings for further unraveling of the wonders of creation. I-81, pointing to the revelation of the Noble Quran to the Prophet by the Creator of the universe, poses the question in the next ayah on the denial of this manifest truth by the disbelievers and how these deviated persons make a living by continuing to deny facts and realities in order to mislead the ignorant people. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, divine oath on the wonders of creation is very significant and implies the highly honored status of the Noble Quran, which the Almighty Creator has revealed for the guidance of all mankind by urging them to reflect on its rational and dynamic contents. Number two, the flawless veracity of the Noble Quran is free of any vain discourse or interpolation, and thus, in order to strengthen faith and benefit from its bezels of wisdom, it should be touched in the state of cleanliness and after due ablution. Number three, it is only the Prophet and his purified progeny, Quran, who know the inner meaning of the ayahs of the Noble Quran and thus further open the vistas of knowledge for the seekers of truth. And number four, negligence, trivialization, and denial of the manifest truth of the Noble Quran results from disbelief in the day of resurrection. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 83, 84, 85, 86, and 87 of the same surah.
فَلَوْلَا إِذَا بَلَغَتِ الْحُلْقُومَ وَأَنْتُمْ حِينَئِذٍ تَنْظُرُونَ وَنَحْنُ أَقْرَبُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْكُمْ وَلَكِنْ لَا تُبْصِرُونَ فلولا إن كنتم غير مدينين ترجعونها إن كنتم صادقين.
So when it, the soul leaving the body, reaches the throat of the dying person, while you are looking on, and we are nearer to him than you are, though you do not perceive, then why do you not, if you are not subject to the divine dispensation, restore it, should you be truthful? These ayahs hint at God's power of resurrection by pointing to the last moments of a person's life when none can avert death, which is decreed by the Almighty Creator, who is nearer to every one of us than our own selves. Although most do not realize this fact, owing to their fickle faith or lack of faith. The intention here is to awaken the conscience of the helpless onlookers who are also destined to meet the same fate. Despite modern sophisticated technical and medical equipment, which cannot compensate human weakness, thereby exposing the liars and deniers who doubt resurrection and the Day of Judgment. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the power that gave life and decreed death can resurrect the dead from rotten and powdered bones for the final judgment. And number two, no one, including modern scientific technology, have the power to avert death, let alone restoring the dead to life. Thank you. Now, in conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which also marks completion of Surah Waqia, we present you ayahs 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, 93, 94, 95, and 96.
فَأَمَّا إِنْ كَانَ مِنَ الْمُقَرَّبِينَ فَرَوْحٌ وَرَيْحَانٌ وَجَنَّةُ نَعِيمٍ وَأَمَّا إِنْ كَانَ مِنْ أَصْحَابِ الْيَمِينِ فَسَلَامٌ لَكَ مِنْ أَصْحَابِ الْيَمِينِ وَأَمَّا إِنْ كَانَ مِنَ الْمُكَذِّبِينَ الضَّالِّينَ فَنُزُلٌ مِّنْ حَمِيمٍ وَتَصْلِيَةُ جَحِيمٍ إِنَّ هَذَا لَهُوَ حَقُّ الْيَقِينِ فَسَبِّحْ بِاسْمِ رَبِّكَ الْعَظِيمِ.
Then, if he be of those brought near to the divine threshold, then ease, abundance, and a garden of bliss. And if he be of the people of the right hand, then greeting to you from the people of the right hand. But if he be of the deniers, the astray ones, then a treat of boiling water, an entry into hell. Indeed, this is the certain truth. So celebrate the name of your Lord, the All Supreme. These ayahs sum up the points discussed in the beginning of the surah, which classifies people into three categories on Resurrection Day on the basis of differing human dispositions at the time of death. Thus, those destined to be near the divine threshold pass away with utmost serenity, peace of mind, and happiness for the abundant bliss of paradise. Those on the right hand also attain felicity and the company of the virtuous in heaven, for having died with faith after repentance in the divine court and seeking of forgiveness from the all-merciful Lord. And for the disbelievers, the deniers of truth, and the unrepentant sinners, death opens up for them the gates of horrible punishment, with boiling water and fall into the fires of hell. This is indeed the undeniable truth, and we should therefore celebrate the name of the Lord Most High. These ayahs teach us that, number one, people are generally scared of death, but for those who are firm of faith and have abstained from sins, or those who have repented of their misdeeds and become righteous, death brings for them great bounties, including the bliss of paradise. And number two, as for the disbelievers and unrepentant sinners, the moment the soul leaves the physical body, the never-ending torment begins.
Combatants,
a senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Iran's is no longer a new government, but it is just a year old almost, with what it claims to be a new resolve in making old dreams come true. One dream is reverting from reliance on crude oil exports to a non-oil economy. Well, that's overly ambitious, but to considerably reduce reliance on a single raw resource is perfectly doable, with the right look to management, of course, and a better understanding of macroeconomics.
The year 1404 or 2025 is a target within reach. In financial terms, it's a goal of $75 billion worth of non-oil exports on Iran's agenda. Now, to achieve that volume in 3 years would require more serious investment in certain assets and domains, boosting production being key. For a closer look at those factors, stay with me, Leila Faromarzi, and our show guests here on Iran Today.
To meet the $75 billion mark is to strategize in targeting fresh customers and markets. Iran's look to the east and neighbors has been much talked of. Now it is looking more closely at Africa. Its exports to Africa have increased by 100 to 120%, but it's not yet satisfied. Iran exported $1.2 billion worth of non-oil products to African countries last year. Mr. Bozian is an economic analyst active in Kish Free Trade Zone.
ما صادراتمون رو ما ببینید ما تو قسمت مواد غذایی شاید بخشی که
In food exports we can work on sectors in which they cannot work due to weather conditions. I have information that some Iranian goods are exported in bulk, but after being processed they are packed with the name of another country. This is partly because import regulations in some countries do not allow the imports of processed goods. That's why we emphasize on producing goods with high value added. The value added actually comes from processing the goods. So we need to produce goods that are as close as possible to the final product. What are stone, saffron, or fruits are exported in bulk and then they will be processed or even mixed with other products and then supplied under the name of an African country, for instance. In foodstuff exports, we have advantages. We're also strong in exporting industrial goods like construction materials.
Iran boasts it achieved a $605 million positive trade balance in the first 3 months of the current Iranian calendar year beginning March the 21st, with its non-oil exports having increased 19.5% and foreign transit 32%. This was while the country was undergoing economic reforms and at the same time as the Ukraine war and the Shanghai quarantine, not to forget U.S. sanctions and hostility toward Iranian businessmen. Mr. Sheikhi is an economic analyst who also teaches at university. He came to the studio to share his view of pros and cons with the economic situation while explaining how the cons have not been easy to avoid.
Our non-oil exports increased by 40% in 2021. In the first 3 months of this year, our export levels grew by 19.5%. Our non-oil exports in the first 3 months of this year grew by 21%. In agriculture, if we reform our irrigation system, we can supply products for 300 million people. But our water efficiency is very low. The results of our research are not applied in our farmlands. If they are applied, our production increases by two or threefold. The farms that have reformed their irrigation system water efficiency has quadrupled and production has increased twice or three times the number it was before. This way, the agricultural efficiency has increased by 8 to 9 times. The situation in our agriculture is just an example.
The Trade Promotion Organization TPO head Ali Reza Peymanpak said, during the current government's administration, all ministers and officials that have visited other countries have been accompanied by trade delegations. He continued, exports to Turkey have increased by 100%. And any decrease in exports to Iraq of late are down to the increase in the prices of Iranian goods. And that, in turn, is due to the elimination of the subsidized currency allocations for some goods. Mr. Lahouti is Exports Confederation Chair at Iran's Chamber of Commerce. After a long time, he joined us again, this time on Skype.
If you're talking about a 100% increase in our exports to the United Arab Emirates, this is a huge number and it should be fact-checked. But having a 100% increase in our exports to African countries is feasible, because our trade value with the African countries might be a small number, and a little change can increase it by 100%. Regarding Turkey, I believe that the policy of our current administration and the previous administration have been based on increasing trade volume with neighboring countries, and Turkey is one of our most important trade partners. And in fact, it is among the first five destinations of Iran's exports. In the current situation, they've had good cooperation with us. And we even saw the Turkish president making a visit to Iran, and the two countries agreed on some issues. Therefore, thanks to those efforts, the volume of our export to Turkey increased by 40% last year.
The significance of the $75 billion mark is that it is to cover non-oil exports, else the figure per se is nothing new, because Iran's total exports did reach under $72.5 billion in December of 2021. That was an increase of 11.7% year-on-year. The country's total imports, on the other hand, recorded under $39 billion in March of 2021. That was a decrease of 11.7% year-on-year. Why the insistence on non-oil exports is the detrimental effects of single-product oil exports on Iran's economy and past, which linger on till today.
In curing old scars, the system wants to develop non-oil exports for continuous economic growth. Getting the country's economy out of the single-product structure would help improve the balance of foreign exchange payments and increase the country's power in global markets.
Our problem is not liquidity, since our banks have enough money in their hands. But the problem is that our banks are not interested in contributing and realizing the country's major goals. They're looking for their own interests. They're constructing trade centers, buildings, and so on. These activities happen inside the country and they cannot be exported. Therefore, the banks should be tasked to have productive activities. On the other hand, some critics say that this way our economy becomes prescriptive. But the problem is that when the banks are engaged in lucrative activities inside the country, they will never turn to exports.
Why the sudden resolve all of a sudden to move from oil exports to non-oil exports? Because we've been talking of it for years and years.
When Ayatollah Raisi became the head of Iran's judiciary, we used to see activities in two sections, productive and non-productive activities. He made non-productive activities partly insecure. He created some restrictions for non-productive activities, and at the same time, he provided facilities for productive activities. For example, during his tenure at the judiciary, he restored around 2,000 out of 5,000 manufacturing units that had been shut down. He assisted productive activities.
Talking of ports and free trade zones, the Sistan-Baluchistan Industry, Mines and Trade Department emphasized the development of exports and proper entry into world markets and maintaining the conditions of survival in them cannot be achieved except by creating a clear and sustainable export strategy that has become unchangeable by law and each of the executive agencies.
We don't have an industrial strategy and we don't have a correct trade strategy either. And if we have one, we're not committed to it. If you take a look at our country's development plans, the only one which was successful by over 50% was the fourth development plan. And the rest I've seen have been implemented by less than 30%. This shows that we're not committed to the programs that we have set out. and we lose potentials during the implementation phase. Therefore, I believe that we have untapped potentials in exports, but unfortunately, we did not succeed in taking advantage of them. In the final 3 years of Iran's previous administration, our national currency depreciated, and that could help increasing our export income, but we couldn't make it.
To remove logistical obstacles to achieving its goals, Iran is going to have to do some serious investing. We are talking intensive infrastructure development in energy, transportation, and communication, which is what connected the traditional economic powerhouses of the West with new centers of influence in the East and South.
What would you say are the logistical hindrances to reverting from oil exports to non-oil exports?
Our logistic barriers include a decrease in investment within the past 8 years. In particular, we have witnessed a decrease in our net investment. Our gross investment, which includes depreciation, has been very low or even none. When the government publicly concedes defeat and says that all of our programs are intertwined to sanctions, it practically stops all kinds of investments. They also rely on foreigners and say that whenever the Western countries start cooperating with us, our problems will be solved. But we've seen the opposite. According to the statistics of Iran's central bank, we had negative growth in the first two quarters of the previous Iranian year. But the economic growth in the third and fourth quarters of the same year were 5.7%. This is while the growth of our oil sales was just 0.2%. This shows that our economy was activated because we had new managers. The new government said that we can do it.
Iran's sanctions imposed isolation from international markets was concurrent with the period in which these markets saw unprecedented levels of integration and interconnectivity. And now to catch up, globalization is at the top of Iran's post-sanctions economic agenda. In talking connectivity, no doubt working on transportation routes for shipping out exports is of paramount importance, as is diplomacy to secure relations with third countries on transit routes between, say, Iran and Russia.
The alliance of the sanction club is actually changing. The Western countries have realized since 10 to 15 years ago that the dollar is falling. They have been looking for replacement for the huge bulk of dollar notes that are not supported by the proportionate gross domestic product. If this money is sent back to the United States and Europe at once, they cannot compensate the ensuing loss. So they decided to resolve this complicated situation, and then they introduced cryptocurrency to the world.
Chamber of Commerce Chief Shafi pointed to Iran's inadequate port infrastructure and called the unavailability of ro-ro ships a serious weakness in trade relations between Iran and Russia. There are problems to fix also in the rail and road transportation sectors, including the low speed of rail transportation and the increase in the cost of goods. Bursan Bazar observes, infrastructure is foundational in a very literal sense, and functional geography is more important than political geography. Rather than focus on how the world is organized across political borders and alliances, we should focus on how we actually use the world through infrastructure. The reason is, infrastructure provides connectivity, and with the present tug-of-war between security and connectivity, connectivity seems to be the winner in securing relations between countries. At least that's how it's been between Iran and the US and China.
The swap of Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan was just the first step. The train that crossed Iran into Turkey when Turkmenistan's president was in Iran had started its journey from China. As you know, railroad is the most efficient way to transport goods. For example, if you compare the duration of transportation, you see that a journey from China to Europe that takes 45 days on a ship will be completed in 5 days with a train. We see that rail corridors from the east to the west are being activated, and Iran is on this international path. These corridors are activating Shanghai Cooperation and Eurasia pacts. Now, we see that more countries are bidding to join these pacts as new member states. This way, Iran's economy will be boosted significantly.
Just look at the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran, the U.S., and other world powers. Iran and the U.S. did not develop any closer ties than before. That's because the U.S. showed it had little to offer by way of connectivity when it didn't lift primary sanctions off Iran, as expected by the deal.